It's the 23rd of March 2012, and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a podcast about interesting things. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up this week, we answer the questions: who won Secularist of the Year? And why was Baroness Farzi snubbed? Can religion be taken out of the courtroom, or is the jury still out on that? Can non-religious people pray for someone, or does it just look like they're clapping really slowly? Does IPCC climate change scientist Michael Mann believe in man-made climate change? And if so, is he blaming himself too much? How are the Pirate Party doing in Germany? And do pirates hosting a party make fancy dress options slightly more restrictive? And why, oh why, do I really want an iPad? But first, the traditional begging slot. If you enjoy the Pod Delusion and would like to support what we do, then do head over to our website and make a one-off donation, or subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month. All donations are greatly appreciated and really do help us continue to put the show together week after week. It's a bit like buying us two drinks a month, so go on. You can find links to do so at poddelusion.co.uk. Also, we've teamed up with Audible, the audiobook company. If you head over to the Pod Delusion website and follow the links through to Audible, you can download a free audiobook. There's thousands of titles available, from Ben Goldacre's Bad Science to Sam Harris's Moral Landscape, and you can get one for absolutely free if you sign up via the Pod Delusion. Again, you can find the link to that at poddelusion.co.uk. Now that's out of the way, let's start this week's show, and we start this week with an award. Don't worry, I'm not once again going to arrogantly boast about the fact that we won the Best Podcast Award from the Skeptic Magazine Awards, but instead, it's last Saturday's National Secular Society Secularist of the Year Award. So last Saturday was the award ceremony itself, and it was announced that this year's winner was the human rights campaigner Peter Tatchell, who has been tirelessly campaigning for secular values for decades. Shortly after his win, Liz Luckendorf managed to have a brief chat with Peter.
So we're here with Peter Tatchell, who is the Irwin Prize winner of 2012. Congratulations.
Well, it's a huge, huge honour. This is a very prestigious award. And, you know, when I consider the long history of secularists and humanists who've made great sacrifices, often with their liberty, sometimes with their lives, it's an immense honour to accept this prize.
And you're happy to have the term secularist after all, you know, we're the militant secularists here, and the government and the press don't seem to be too fond of us. What do you make of all that kind of hubbub in the media right now?
I think it's an incredible distortion, because the reality is that secularists are simply seeking an equal level playing field. We don't want religion privileged. We don't want religion exempt from our equality laws. We don't believe that clerics ought to sit of right in the House of Lords. We want to see sex and relationship education taught without religious influence in schools. These are simple humanitarian values, and the real militants and extremists are, of course, organized religion and the fundamentalists, who believe that they have the absolute truth and that their truth should be imposed upon everyone else.
You mentioned in your acceptance speech this afternoon about the really appalling record of the Commonwealth to deal with the countries that don't have the best human rights record going. What can we do to change that? Can we put pressure on the Commonwealth group as a whole, or individual countries, to help bring to light this kind of discrepancy within the Commonwealth?
We have a major, major problem in that the Commonwealth has an ostensible commitment to the values of human rights, democracy, the rule of law, equality, non-discrimination, and personal freedom. Those are Commonwealth values, yet the majority of Commonwealth states violate those values. You know, some still have the death penalty, some censor the press, some detain people without trial, some torture their citizens, others deny women equal rights, deny equality to lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people, and persecute minority nationalities and faiths. When member states violate human rights in the most severe, gross, and systematic way, so often the Commonwealth stays silent. Well, you know, if you belong to this club, you ought to abide by the rules, and the leadership of the Commonwealth needs to say very loud and clear that member states that violate human rights, that deny freedom of speech, that they are not conforming to Commonwealth values, and they either ought to be suspended or threatened with suspension. There needs to be really serious, public, high-profile pressure put on those countries, because it's not right that an organisation committed to humanitarian values in many member states allows the violation of those values.
And in direct contrast with that, the government's about to undergo a consultation on equal marriage for gay couples. Do you see this as a very positive thing from the same government that is hysterically crying about militant secularism?
Well, absolutely. The battle for same-sex civil marriage, and indeed for the right of heterosexual couples to have a civil partnership if they wish, and moreover, for the right of religious organisations that want to conduct religious same-sex marriages, these three rights, these three freedoms, these three opportunities are something that religious organisations are fighting tooth and nail, and the government, sadly, has only agreed to one of them. The government's committed to same-sex civil marriages, but it will not allow heterosexual civil partnerships, and it will not allow religious same-sex marriages by faith organisations that want to conduct them. That's not only an attack upon the rights and freedoms of LGBT people, it's also an attack upon religious freedom. Religions do not have a right to discriminate, but when religious organisations like the Quakers, the Unitarians, the Metropolitan Community Church and Liberal Jews do not wish to discriminate, when they want to provide equal marriage rights for same-sex couples, for the government to deny them that right is an attack upon religious freedom.
And for the coming year, in 2012, what do you plan on campaigning against, and what do you think everyone else as a secularist community should be looking into and supporting?
Well, the big, big fight of this year is going to be to get same-sex civil marriage. We are going to have a huge fight because the religious right, the organised leaderships of the faith communities are dead against same-sex marriages, even civil marriages in a register office. They are mobilising their members. We have to mobilise to counter their influence and pressure. So I'd urge everyone to go on the Government Equality's website and fill in the submission form to support the claim for equal rights. We can be sure religious organisations are going to swamp the government, so we have to produce counter-pressure. But there are other issues on the horizon as well. There is the bubbling issue of reform of the House of Lords. We have to say very loud and clear that having any clerics of any denomination in the House of Lords as of right, without election, is not compatible with a democratic society. We need to say very clearly that religious schools do not have the right to inculcate their pupils with prejudice and dogma. Religious organisations at the moment have certain rights to teach sex and relationship education in accordance with their own particular faith ethos. And we know that many of those faiths hold that homosexuality is immoral, sinful, abnormal, unnatural, and many of them would like to make it criminal. Let's make sure that we challenge that and insist that the government must stay true to a sex and relationship education that's factual, objective, based on scientific knowledge and understanding about human sexuality, and that it doesn't give in or allow exemptions for religious bodies and organisations.
Are there any other campaigns you're working on?
Well, my campaigns span many different countries, and the idea is to support and work with human rights defenders in those countries. So one of my campaigns is around democracy and human rights in Iran, which concerns not only opposition to the theocratic regime and the call for a secular, democratic government in Iran, but also to support persecuted ethnic and religious minorities. In Iran, the Kurdish, Baluch, Arab and Azeri minorities suffer great persecution and disadvantage. Iran is, in essence, sort of a racist neo-colonial state, which is holding these minority peoples in subjugation. It's also, as a Shia-dominated state, persecuting Sunni Muslims and people of other faiths, like Baha'is. Many Baha'i people have been arrested, imprisoned, often detained for years without trial, in some instances killed. This shows what happens when religion is allowed to be part of the state. When you give privilege to one particular faith, you end up persecuting not only non-believers, but also minority faiths as well.
And I'll let you get a drink and enjoy your award, Peter Tetchell. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Also at the award ceremony was the Biddeford councillor, Clive Bone, who you may remember hit the headlines a few weeks ago when he and the NSS got the High Court to rule that Biddeford Council couldn't pray before meetings as part of the official agenda. And if you recall, this kicked off a whole shitstorm, which we've covered in previous weeks. He was also recognised at the event, picking up a special award recognising his work, and Liz managed to have a chat with him too.
So we're here with Clive Bone, who is the Simon Biber Award winner, Memorial Award winner this evening. And if for those of you may not know, what's your claim to fame right now in the secular community?
Well, as a Biddeford Town Councillor, I oppose prayers. We tried to get rid of it by voting, but because of the inbuilt church-going majority, I wasn't able to. So I approached the National Secular Society. They took it up as a legal case, and we won.
What was the reaction from people in your town? Or in, well, we know the reaction of the council, but what do people in your community think of the decision?
Most people seem to be rather indifferent to what goes on in local authorities, but those who are asked say, no, why should we have prayers? After all, if you went to Marks and Spencer's, you wouldn't expect prayers. If they were such a good idea, they'd probably put them on.
What did you think of the reaction that happened in, like, the national media that week when the decision was announced?
I was taken aback, and I was quite surprised at Eric Pickle's reaction. He wanted to try and reintroduce them, which I don't think he has. I would have thought he had better things to do. He ought to be addressing productivity of local government, not their prayers.
And were you a member of the National Secular Society when you brought up your... when you contacted them?
No, but I was a student. So in my student days, I was in the University Humanist Federation over 40 years ago in the 60s. And I knew about them, of course. But I joined recently before I heard about the prize I used to add.
Excellent. And do you have any kind of words of wisdom for people who might be considering this line if their councils are doing the same?
Well, it's very simple. I think it shows that the ordinary people can stand up and be counted and challenge the vested interests of organised religion.
The Irwin Prize winner this afternoon was long-standing campaigner Peter Tatchell. What do you think of him winning the award?
I think it's great. I've always admired his courage. He does things I wouldn't do. And he's obviously a humanist and a great humanitarian. And he's fought tyranny everywhere he can. I think it's a well-deserved prize.
Clive Bone, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You can hear the ceremony in full on the Pod Delusion extra feed or on our website at poddelusion.co.uk. Staying with secularism now, and last Saturday was also the annual conference of the National Federation of Atheist, Humanist and Secular Student Societies, or AHS for short. One of the speakers on the day was Twitter's favourite lawyer and friend of the show, David Alan Green, who launched a new campaign to try and take religion out of the courtroom, so that by default people will affirm and not have to reference their religion by swearing an oath to God. I spoke to David to find out more, so here he is, giving us the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. David, thank you for joining us. You're launching a new campaign, I understand, about religion and the legal system. What's going on?
Well, it's about time, James, that we take religion out of the courtroom. It's not the most important thing. There are other effects of religion in our political and legal system which are more important. But on the other hand, a legal system which is about determining rights, about liability, what criminal liability you have, what civil liability you have. Effectively, it's about coercion. What can the law force you to do? The question is, should religion have any part of that? And what I'm focusing on with this new campaign is oaths. If any of us, anybody listening to the Pod Delusion, witness an incident, either a criminal incident or something to do with civil liability, like a contract or negligence, you will be called to court. You will be asked to go into the witness box, and you will be asked to give evidence. This evidence, what you say to the court, is very important. It can determine somebody's liability. It can determine, in criminal cases, it can determine whether they are going to go to prison or not. In civil cases, it can determine whether they're going to be found liable or not for huge amounts of money. It's incredibly important. And what is the first thing the jury or the judge get to know about you? The first thing they get to know about you is what religion you are. Because you are expected to take a Christian oath in civil and criminal proceedings unless you choose otherwise. Surely that is not the first thing a jury or a judge should know about you.
So is there any evidence that people stating their religion or people that's given religion has changed the outcome of a court proceeding or anything like that?
It's not so much whether there's evidence or not. It's a question of basic principle. When I am about to give evidence to a trial, to a judge and to a jury, I'm taking it seriously. I'm saying things aloud, which I'm hoping those people will rely upon. I want them to know I am taking this seriously. At the moment, I can choose not to take an oath. I can choose to take an oath, so-called affirmation. And I affirm that I would give evidence solemnly. But it's my deliberate choice. The law is actually written that it's the default position is that you give a Christian oath unless you choose otherwise. So there may be evidence for it, there may be evidence against it. One suspects that people accused of terrorism offences who choose not to take a Christian oath and swear on the Quran instead. Okay, there may be some prejudice there. But that's not the point. The point is the principle of what do people, judges and juries, get to know about you when you're giving evidence. I say everybody should just affirm and say, I'm taking this seriously. I realise I might go to prison if I say something false. Let me just say, solemnly, I'm going to tell the truth.
So do you see yourself as trying to finish Charles Bradlaugh's work from over 100 years ago when he got affirmations in Parliament but didn't quite manage to change the legal system?
Well, in a way, secularism moves slowly. Politics and law are about forcing people to do things they otherwise wouldn't do. If we are going to have coercive powers, it's best if it's secular. But what triggered this was the Byford Council case, where it was held, it wasn't within the council's power to insist that there were prayers at the start of council meetings. Of course it isn't. Any sensible person knows that it shouldn't be the business of a public authority to insist that there were prayers and agenda. And that made me think, what point is there in actually insisting that before I give evidence, I am expected to give an oath unless I choose otherwise? And I have been in court where you see people say, oh, I'm going to give an affirmation instead. And people are flustered. They don't know what to do. Oh God, I think we've got an affirmation sheet anyway. But an affirmation is everything there should be. If people want to give some sort of vow to some great sky fairy as well, great, if they can bring their own religious book with them and not expect the taxpayer to pay for it. But the default position should be, I'm giving an affirmation, I'm telling the court, I'm telling the judge, I'm telling the other parties, I'm telling any jury, I'm taking this seriously. And if after giving that affirmation, you want to wave some religious text and swear to a sky fairy, then that's fine. But I don't think that should be part of our legal system.
So what can we do to make this change? What can anyone listening do to help?
There are two things. Raise awareness. Make people realise they can give affirmations as opposed to oaths. Just as a general principle. If we all opt for affirmations, or if many of us opt for affirmations, that would be better. Ultimately, we need to change legislation. As I said, it's not the most important thing. There are other, more dreadful ways which people with religious beliefs affect our political and legal system than this. But this would be a nice to have. And eventually, we can actually reform our legal system, so you just give an affirmation. So it's a slow burner. But in the meantime, if you know anybody who's about to give evidence in court, or if you ever have to give evidence in court, just know, because the court may not tell you, just know you can give an affirmation. You do not have to give a religious oath.
And there's some free advice from a lawyer. David Alan Green, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, James.
Now, how can atheists help when someone is in need? You may remember that when that footballer collapsed the other day, a hashtag about praying for him started trending. But if you're a non-believer, then you can't really contribute to that. So what can you do? I mean, it's not really practical to turn up at a hospital and offer to help out. In my case, I'm not even a qualified doctor, and my last attempt at surgery had a rather messy end. So what can atheists do? Georgia Gale Grant has been pondering this very question.
I wasn't aware that there was any special football match taking place last Saturday until I was browsing Twitter and saw a few tweets along the lines of, "What's happened to Mwamba?" I'm not a fan of football, but I am a fan of both Twitter and people, and so I rapidly discovered that Fabrice Muamba, the 23-year-old Bolton midfielder, had collapsed on pitch due to a cardiac event. I say cardiac event because it is unclear at this time what actually happened, and also because I don't wish to pry into what must be a painful and difficult thing for him, his friends, and his family. For those of you who don't know how things unfolded, shortly before half-time in the FA Cup quarter-final between Bolton Wanderers and Tottenham Hotspur, Muamba collapsed in obvious distress. Paramedics were brought on immediately, and the player received heart massage and defibrillation on the pitch before being transferred to the London Chest Hospital. He was critically ill for some time, but has begun to make a recovery, and I'm delighted to hear this. What I'm not delighted to hear about was the immediate insistence from all and sundry that we should pray for Muamba. Bolton's manager, Owen Coyle, said, "We hope that if everyone can pray strongly tonight, Fabrice is able to recover. No. Probably not going to make much difference, Owen." Muamba's clubmates, Stuart Holden and the England captain, Rio Ferdinand, leapt in with, "Praying for you, Fab," and, "Come on, Fabrice Muamba, praying for you." Gary Cahill, formerly of Bolton, now of Chelsea, lifted his jersey after scoring a goal to reveal a Pray for Muamba t-shirt. And Muamba's fiancé said on Twitter, "God is in control. Keep Muamba in your prayers. It's working. I can feel it." As a humanist, I'm pleased that people can find comfort in prayer, but I have absolutely no intention of praying for Muamba, or anyone else for that matter. Does that make me lacking in compassion? I can't deny I feel mean in withholding my prayers. After all, they mean nothing to me, and it might mean something to someone else, but I think it would be hypocritical. More importantly, I think there are so many more worthwhile things you can do to show your support than petition a frankly unreliable deity. Prayer is, in my opinion, a selfish thing. Let us assume that prayer accomplishes nothing, as there are no omnipotent gods. Who are you really helping, then, by praying? Yourself, of course. You can devote a few minutes of time to thinking about Muamba and then get up and feel like you've done something. You can go back to your life and think, "That's okay, I've prayed for him, it'll be fine." And if it's not, well, God had a plan. How's that helpful? I know someone is going to point out that praying for you is probably just a blanket term meaning that you're in their thoughts, but I want to know, why not say that? Why turn immediately to prayer before exploring some of the more demonstrably successful routes? I'm showing my support for Fabrice Muamba in a different way. I'm recording this segment about him, for a start. I'm thinking about him. I'm hoping that he makes a recovery. I'm pleased the FA rules relating to medical requirements during matches were changed, so that Muamba was able to receive immediate treatment from the standby paramedics. Although really, I do agree with Marina Hyde, who expressed surprise at the self-congratulatory response to the eminently civilised reaction to Muamba's plight. What was the alternative, she asked. No one was not going to give him CPR. So what can we, as humanists and sceptics and atheists, do to show our support if we don't want to offer our prayers? Well, if you're between 14 and 35, you can get regular ECGs to make sure you're not at any known risk of sudden death. The charity Cardiac Risk in the Young offers subsidised screening programmes. There's a link on the Pod Delusion website. You could make sure your friends or children or other relations go too. Although it's not clear what caused Muamba's heart to stop beating, getting yourself checked out can't hurt. You could post a nice message on Twitter or Facebook, tagging it Muamba, so that if he or his family search, they'll have supportive stuff to read. You could donate some of your time or money to a cardiac charity, or write the London Chest Hospital or paramedics a note thanking them for their response. Yes, they were doing their job, but they did it well. You could make sure that every time you see someone in the street who might be in distress, you just find out if they need help. This has been Georgia Gale Grant, wishing Fabrice Muamba a speedy recovery, reporting for The Pod Delusion.
Now, one of the words we use to describe this podcast is sceptical, in that we like to think we're rational, evidence-based type sorts of people. But it's not a perfect word, particularly when you try to ask for an interview with one of the world's leading scientists studying climate change, because annoyingly, a climate change sceptic tends to actually be a climate change denier, or arsehole, as I like to call them. Brilliantly though, Professor Michael E. Mann agreed to speak to us. We thought the interview was broadly about some of the issues and themes in his excellent new book, The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars. But if you take certain bits out of context and ignore the opinions of the overwhelming majority of people who listen to this interview, then you can claim it's about whatever the hell you like. Here's Liz Luckendorf speaking to Michael Mann.
The name Michael Mann might not immediately resonate with all of you, but a certain sports-themed climate graph may well have things fall into place. Michael Mann's career has involved groundbreaking climate research, sharing in a Nobel Peace Prize with Al Gore in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, ClimateGate, and startling attacks on his academic integrity from fossil fuel industry mouthpieces and congressmen alike. His book, The Hockey Stick in the Climate Wars, almost reads like a memoir tracing his life from a bright-eyed graduate student to the current state of climate politics in the US. Michael Mann tells the story of his life and the hockey stick graph. The first question I asked was whether it was fair to compare climate change deniers with creationists.
It is, and in fact, it in a way, it encapsulates the way, the role that I have come to play in the campaign to discredit climate change. I've been at the center of the attacks by climate change deniers for more than a decade because of the work that we did in the last 1990s that resulted in the so-called hockey stick curve that was, you know, essentially it became an icon in the climate change debate because it told with a very simple picture, a story that we are clearly, you know, warming the planet and there's, you know, in an unprecedented manner. So the attacks that my colleagues and I have been subject to are very similar in many ways to the attacks that, you know, evolutionary biologists have been subjected to by those looking to discredit you know, the theory of evolution by creationists and advocates of so-called intelligent design. And in fact, it's the same modus operandi where the forces of anti-science try to take not just a single study or finding, but a single individual and try to make them a target for ridicule and making it seem like all of the science, you know, the entire edifice of our scientific understanding is all a product of a single person, a single scientist. And moreover, that scientist is often portrayed as an enemy. In the case of the theory of evolution, there's a reason that advocates of intelligent design don't want to talk about, you know, the thousands of scientists who have reaffirmed Charles Darwin's findings over the past century and a half, but rather just Charles Darwin, to personalize it, to make it sound like it all rests on the back of one single individual. And if you can discredit that individual, then the entire science will come crumbling down. That's what they've been trying to do with Charles Darwin for 150 years. And that's what they've been trying to do in the case of climate science. We are subject to the same sorts of attacks that have been used by the forces of anti-science for well over a century.
The thing that struck me about the way you structured your book as well is how many people you had collaborated with, and in a sense that worked against you when they tried to use it against you. So what exactly makes up climate scientists? What fields and research areas are involved to provide these models and evidence for climate change?
That's a great question. And it's sort of, I actually try to give readers a sense of that, where I sort of use my personal history, my evolution from a budding theoretical physicist to an individual who ultimately found themselves at the center of this raging public debate over human-caused climate change. I was a theoretical physicist by training, applied math and physics from the University of California, Berkeley, started a PhD in theoretical physics at Yale University. This was a time in the late 1980s when funding was being cut for major physics projects like the superconducting supercollider in the U.S. And so suddenly, if you were a physicist, there wasn't funding for you to just work on any problem that you wanted to. Increasingly, we were being funneled into working on fairly applied problems. In my case, sort of the theory of solid-state devices. It wasn't the big-picture science that had gotten me interested in physics in the first place. And so I literally opened up the catalog at the university where I was studying, Yale University, to see what else was going on around campus, where I could use the math and physics that I had acquired to work on a problem, a bigger problem, and one with real world implications. And in the end, I found that there was a scientist down the hill from the physics department in the Department of Geology and Geophysics who was using physics and math to work on this wonderful, amazing problem, modeling the behavior of Earth's climate system. And it is, to me, it's sort of the ultimate science problem because there's physics and math involved. And, you know, as somebody who sort of cut their teeth in those fields, it's a natural opportunity for me to apply, you know, the training that I had as an undergraduate and then when I went on into physics and graduate school to work on this big problem. But it also involves biology. You have to know something about the biosphere and the carbon cycle. It involves chemistry, understanding the radiative properties of various gases in our atmosphere, you know, in particular the greenhouse gases. And so it brings together so many different areas of science where you're now no longer just a physicist or a mathematician. You're needing to learn to work with, to collaborate with chemists and biologists and increasingly even the social sciences to look at sort of the interaction between human behavior and carbon emissions, which feed back on the climate system. So it's this amazing science problem, and you can come into it from a variety of different directions, but ultimately by working in this field, you become an intrinsically interdisciplinary scientist. And to me, that's one of the most exciting things about this field.
The other thing that struck me is how various denialists would try to cherry pick sets or pieces of data sets, which seemed ridiculous as there seemed to be quite a comprehensive set and like a lot of data behind these analyses. Can you give us some sort of sense of the scale of data that you're working with?
Absolutely. And so, you know, this is a science which is both observational in nature. You know, we collect data sets to try to build up a picture of how the climate has changed in the past, is changing today. And much of my work, you know, the hockey stick was an effort to reconstruct the climate history many centuries back in time, 1,000 years back in time, using indirect data like tree rings and corals and ice cores that go much farther back than the relatively short thermometer records we have that span, you know, a little more than the past century. But we do have these widespread thermometer records over the past century. We have records of sea level pressure and wind patterns and ocean currents. And so we have these very rich measurements, and we have a picture from them of how the climate has been changing. And we can also then perform experiments where we use models, the theoretical models of the climate system that embrace the physics and the chemistry and even the biology that I was talking about earlier, an effort to describe how this system ought to behave and how it ought to be changing. We can actually look at what the models predict should have happened and should be happening and compare it with what the observations are showing, and there is a remarkable match. And in fact, that match tells us that not only can we explain the changes that are happening in terms of our, you know, fossil fuel emissions and the impact they're having on the climate system, but if we take those same models and subject them only to natural factors, like the small but measurable changes in the brightness of the sun over time and the change in the frequency and intensity of explosive volcanic eruptions, we put those into the models, and not only can't they explain the warming of the past century, they predict cooling in recent decades, just the opposite of what we've seen. And so this is an area of the science where you can really bring together observations and theory in a remarkable way. So, you know, and it's so much more difficult to inform, to try to describe what we do know and then what we can conclude, than to sort of disingenuously try to pick holes, sort of highlight minor issues that don't impact the larger picture and pretend that they somehow undermine the case for climate change. And that's really at the core of the attacks against our work. There are literally dozens of independent lines of evidence for the reality of climate change, human-caused climate change and global warming, for the clear role of human activity in the observed changes, and for the proposition that we will see much greater changes and damaging impacts in the future if we continue on this course that we're on, if we continue to pursue business as usual with fossil fuel emissions. You know, you can try to pick holes in any one line of evidence, but there's literally no way to explain the collective evidence and all these different independent approaches to the problem. There's no way that one could come to any other conclusion given the multiple lines of evidence for this. And so what those looking to discredit the science will do is pretend that it all hinges on one line of evidence, and not even just one line of evidence, like paleoclimate reconstructions. They'll pretend that it depends on one decade-old study by one group, or even they'll try to make it seem by one person, as if I didn't even have co-authors. It's all Mike Mann and his hockey stick from the late 1990s, when in fact that study and even the collective evidence from all of the reconstructions since, which have reaffirmed our findings, are just one in, like I said, dozens of independent lines of evidence for the reality of human-caused climate change. And so it's unfortunate to me that rather than having the good faith debate that we could be having about how precisely to tackle this problem, what policies to enact to deal with human-caused climate change, we are still, in some circles, in the public discourse, to some extent, stuck in this bad faith debate about whether the problem is even real. And we have to move beyond that and have an honest discussion of what to do about the problem and accept that the science is in. As far as the conclusion that we are warming the planet and changing the climate, the science is in. There are still a number of uncertainties, some of them pretty important in the details, in how precise rainfall and drought patterns in Europe and North America will shift, how the El Nino phenomenon will change. There are some big open questions, and they have implications for policy, especially adaptation, because we have to know what's coming if we're going to adapt to the changes that are coming. But there is essentially no uncertainty in the larger picture, that we're warming the planet, we're raising sea level, we're melting ice. If we continue on this course, we are going to be leaving our children and grandchildren a degraded planet.
And I think we can sort of tout you as our first Nobel Peace Prize winner, maybe. we've had some Nobel scientists on, but not Peace Prize winners, so we'll skew the facts a little bit in that case. Michael Mann, thank you very much for coming on our show.
Thank you, Liz. It was a pleasure talking with you.
I can't tell you how many times I was rather apoplectic over what Michael Mann had to go through, and I highly encourage you to read the book to see what scientists can face if confronted with industries and wealthy people who are dead set against the implication of your research. There is a much longer version of this interview on the Poddelusion website, which includes the direct attacks he had to face from Congressman Joe Barton, and if there's any hope of avoiding the worst of climate change. You can find links to buy The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars by Michael Mann on the Poddelusion website. This has been Liz Lusendorf for the Poddelusion.
Now, space elevators have been suggested for years as a means of getting into space, but are they actually feasible? In this next report, Sean Ellis has been trying to figure this out. Now, I don't know much about space elevators, but I do know that if you're in one, don't ask if anyone wants to go back to your room for coffee, as it's going to be a very long journey indeed.
Hello. Imagine I live on the 8th floor of a tower block, just across the way from Mary, Mungo and Midge. I've invited you round to visit, and you're in the car park. I've just put the kettle on, but I'm 20 metres above you. How do you solve this problem and get to me for your cup of tea? I think the answer's obvious. You perch yourself on a big tank of cryogenic propellant, light the blue touch paper, and rocket yourself up to the 8th floor. You don't? Oh, that's right, you don't. Unless you're Andrew Lansley visiting a hospital, most people find it much easier to take the lift. It's the 21st century, so why are we still using rockets to get into space? They're clumsy, expensive, disposable, well, at least until SpaceX get their next generation of launch vehicles ready, and they tend to go bang occasionally. They're applied chemistry, so rockets feel a bit retro to me. Sorry. One alternative is the equivalent of taking the lift, a space elevator. It's not a new idea. The first space elevator design was suggested in 1895 by Russian space pioneer Konstantin Tsiolkovsky. One quick recap before we go on, as we'll be referring to geostationary orbits a lot. As long as a satellite is exactly at a particular altitude, it will naturally orbit at one revolution per day. and if it's in the plane of the equator, it will appear to hover directly over one spot on the Earth. Tsiolkovsky's proposition was to build a tower directly under the satellite, tall enough to reach it. Then you just take a lift up the tower, disembark at the top floor of your satellite, and voila, there you are, in orbit. Simple. Except that geostationary orbit is 35,786 kilometres high. The tallest structure we've ever built, the Burj Khalifa, is only about 800 metres high, and we're reaching the limits of the strengths of common materials even there. The ground floor of the tower has to support the weight of everything above it and not buckle sideways. Scaling this up to 1,600 metres or even a few kilometres seems possible using more exotic materials. But scaling it by a factor of over 40,000 times is just not going to work. Nothing is that strong and stiff. But you can ignore the stiffness if you build structures that hang rather than stand. Perhaps the most famous example of this technique in fiction is Arthur C. Clarke's novel The Fountains of Paradise, where he envisioned a diamond-like crystal being grown downward from a carbonaceous asteroid in geostationary orbit. His proposed elevator cable was several tens of metres across, tapered and huge. In the novel it was christened the billion-ton diamond, and the lifts ran on tracks attached to the outside and powered by superconducting cables. That's a serious elevator. But for years it was simply an SF staple. There wasn't anything with the right combination of lightness and strength to actually do the job. But it turned out that Clarke's selection of carbon for the cable might have been right on the money. Carbon nanotubes are getting tantalisingly close to something that is both light and strong enough to be dangled all the way from geostationary orbit down to the ground. The total thickness of the cable is surprisingly largely irrelevant to whether it can hold its own weight. If you double the diameter, you quadruple the mass, but you quadruple the strength at the same time, so it cancels out. The only thing it does affect, though, is whether it's feasible to get it up there in the first place. So a lot of work has gone into designing the lightest possible cable that could do the job, just so that conventional rockets can actually carry the thing up there in the first place. One design, favoured by elevator think tank company Liftport before they went bust, was to have a wide, very thin ribbon wound onto a bobbin. Think of the world's largest roll of cling film and you won't go far wrong. This would be fired into geostationary orbit and then deployed downwards. Why a ribbon? Well, first, it's resilient. In orbit, meteoroids and space debris abound. With a thin cable elevator, if it gets hit by something sufficiently big, it will get severed and you'll have several thousand miles of cable falling to Earth. Not good. And when I say something sufficiently big, I mean something about the size of a sand grain. An earlier proposed solution to this problem was a hoi tether, which looks a bit like a fishnet stocking. Any of the individual strands can fail, leaving the others to take up the slack, but it's fiddly to manufacture and difficult to deploy. A ribbon is similarly redundant, in that the meteoroids make little holes, but don't affect the overall strength of the ribbon too much. Plus, it's easier to make. If it breaks, it flutters rather than screaming into the atmosphere, and you can simply unroll it. I say simply, but so far, every tether deployment tried in space has failed. The other problem is that we have made something like 30 centimetres of carbon nanotube ribbon so far. There's nothing obvious in the way of scaling up production, but it will take time and effort. Before we get to elevator grade ribbon, though, we do get a range of products that are useful for all sorts of earthbound applications, so it's not an all-or-nothing proposition. Once the cable's in place and anchored on the ground at the equator, how do we climb it? We obviously don't move the cable like in a conventional lift. Instead, we need climbers that latch onto the ribbon and climb up it. At its crudest, this is just a system of rollers and an electric motor. It would take quite some time to get to the top. Even at the speed of a TGV train, we're talking about 5 or 6 days. For cargo, that's not too much of a problem, though. You can have several climbers going up at any one time as long as you don't exceed the limits of the cable. Of course, there's another problem here. Power. Cables are heavy and expensive, and unlike the SF novels, we don't have room temperature superconductors. Well, not yet. So they're lossy too. The solution to this is to use beamed power, usually embodied by a large laser beam. This is received on the climber using photovoltaic panels and converted to electricity to run the motors. We can beam these up from the ground, or later, down from the top of the elevator, where we might have a solar power station. Despite this apparent simplicity, there are a number of very formidable challenges here, even after we have the materials. How do we deploy it properly? How will loads travelling up the cable affect it? Will it snake around uncontrollably? Can the beam power work efficiently enough over these kinds of distances? And what happens if we can't make the nanotubes strong enough in the first place? Liftport recently restarted with a modified mission statement. Since building cables to the Earth is right on the edge of material strengths available, why not start easier with a smaller world? They now want to begin by building a space elevator on the Moon. Obviously, it's more expensive to get there in the first place, and we still have to get stuff off the Earth using rockets, but as a first step, it's still useful. Oh, one last thing. What's the first payload you send up the elevator once you've built it? Another elevator, of course. You don't want all your eggs up one beanstalk. This is Sean Ellis, imagining a view from the top for the Pod Delusion.
It looks like pirates could be on the verge of seizing power. Not in Somalia, though, but in Germany, where the Pirate Party looks set to do well in the forthcoming set of elections. I'm looking forward to America sending in SEAL Team 6 to free the German legislators being held hostage to controversial opinions on intellectual property law. Here's Sven Rudloff with more.
News from Germany. The pirates are taking over. I'm not talking about marine privateers, but about the German Pirate Party. You may have heard about these kind of pirates a few years ago. In 2006, the Swedish Pirate Party was the first to be founded, and affiliate groups soon followed in more than 20 countries. The original Swedish pirates are rooted in digital rights activism, like the notorious BitTorrent tracker The Pirate Bay. After the media and film industries used the pirate label in campaigns against copyright infringement, these activists deliberately chose to go with the label in an attempt to reclaim it. The pirates regard the current copyright system as unbalanced and push for its reform. Private copies should be allowed, and only commercial use of copyrighted material should be regulated. More general, at the core of the Pirate Party manifesto are issues linked to the opportunities and the risks of the Internet age. The pirates promote the freedom of information and the free exchange of knowledge, including free education, while strengthening the right to individual privacy. They want more transparency in governmental affairs and more direct democracy and participation. They lobby for more diversity, equality, universal healthcare, and, at least in Germany after quite some discussion, a basic income guarantee. The pirate parties focus on these issues and don't have an all-encompassing program. For example, they usually lack a specific economic and budgetary strategy. They also don't actively position themselves on the traditional left-right scale. Commentators, however, describe them as social, liberal, and progressive. In general, the pirate parties haven't been very successful so far. In the European elections in 2009, the Swedish party got 7% of the votes and 2 seats in the EU Parliament. However, in general elections, even in Sweden, the pirates usually get less than 1% of the votes and no seats. However, the winds are changing in Germany. In the last general election in 2009, the pirates still got no seats, but at 2% of the votes, they were the largest of such unrepresented small parties. Smaller parties have always proven critical in recent German history. The two traditional heavy hitters, the Conservatives and the Social Democrats, usually need a partner to get a majority, both on federal and on state level. For the Conservatives, this partner was usually the Liberals, and for the Social Democrats, it usually was the Green Party. However, the current Conservative-Liberal coalition government hasn't fared well. The next general election is still a year off, but the recent state elections haven't really boosted the coalition's confidence. More precisely, the Liberals are imploding. Enter the pirates. Last September, in the elections for the state of Berlin, the Liberals got less than 2% of the votes and got kicked out of parliament. At the same time, the pirates got almost 9% and 15 seats, which was kind of lucky, as they only had 15 candidates anyway. This was a wake-up call for everyone. The Pirate Party quickly passed 20,000 members, and the press took note. You can imagine what coverage of a young, fiercely democratic party looks like. They try to find their feet in the political establishment, make unavoidable personal, political, and procedural mistakes, but overall they are a breath of fresh air, and hence news. It almost feels like a flashback. 30 years ago, from the anti-nuclear and environmental movement, the Green Party originated, a motley crew of idealists driven by a few specific issues that were neglected by the established parties but vital for young voters. As kingmakers for government majorities, the Greens were able to push their agenda ever since. Now it's the digital natives, disillusioned with how the traditional parties, now including the Greens, handle the internet revolution. Until recently, I hadn't realized that the German Green Party, progressive as it may have been, for too long had been not only anti-nuclear, but anti-technology. While similar parties in other countries embraced the internet and new media early, the Greens were far too hesitant. So even for them, the respective issues are open flanks where the pirates can prosper. Under normal circumstances, 2012 would have been a boring German election year, with only one regular state election planned in Schleswig-Holstein. However, the conservative-liberal coalition in Saarland broke up in January, and just now early elections have been called in my home state North Rhine-Westphalia. In all three states, it's rather unlikely that the liberals will make the cut for any seats at all, and the pirates are considered rising stars, or at least serious contenders to allow for social democratic and green coalition majorities. The next general election in Germany is scheduled for 2013. In current polls, the pirates consistently show up at 7%. Germany could well become the first country with pirate party MPs, and with a little bit of luck, they may be even required for a majority. So watch that space. This is Sven Rudloff for the Podillusion.
Finally this week, Alex Fitch has been coming to terms with an addiction that I think we can all relate to. It's a very serious subject, so here's Alex to explain more.
Hello everyone. Thank you for giving me such a warm welcome to this group. It's my first time at a meeting like this, so forgive me if I stumble over my words a bit and ramble, but I'm not used to speaking in public. Oh, sorry, I have to say my name and why I'm here. My name's Alex Fitch, and I'm addicted to gadgets. First of all, I'd like to say how I immediately felt at home in this group of people. We don't all exactly have the same problem, but I was moved by James's speech just before me about his addiction to cameras. How he started off with a disposable when he was a kid, and then bought a Polaroid and a Minolta and a Leica, and then moved on to digital cameras and exchangeable lenses, and soon how it began to take over his life. I know how he feels. I guess my love of gadgets began when I was a child also. I had various computers and video games that you plugged into the TV when I was growing up, and I enjoyed using those. I loved my BBC Micro and my Nintendo Entertainment System. But it was handheld gadgets I loved the most. I had played with the odd Game & Watch and borrowed a friend's Game Boy once or twice. But it was only when they moved from monochrome to colour that my love for those devices really began. I was at boarding school in my teens when the PC Engine GT came out. It was a Japanese brick of a machine, black with chunky late 1980s styling and a 2.6-inch screen. It took games on little HU cards that looked like bigger versions of the SD camera memory cards you have today, and they contained mainly arcade games like R-Type and Wonder Boy. I loved my GT. I used it to play games on buses, in trains, in bed and on benches in shaded parts of the playground. I've always liked slightly obscure games machines. I don't know anyone else who owns a Panasonic Q, a mirror-fronted machine that plays GameCube games and DVDs, or a Pioneer Laser Active, a Laserdisc player that also plays Sega games. And so the appeal of the GT was intensified by the fact that it had to be imported from Japan, as did the games, with Kenji menus on screen that you had to navigate with trial and error. This was before eBay, so I also had to go to rarefied gaming shops to feed my addiction, to the subterranean and slightly seedy basement of the Computer Exchange on Rathbone Place in London, where they sold retro games, to Raven Games in the Badlands between Bromley and Beckenham, to telly games on the ring road outside Leicester. Each of these places was like an Aladdin's cave, offering obscure games and obscure machines from every part of the world, and every accessory for them that you could think of. My GT went missing on a school trip, and so I bought the newer model, the LT, which was thinner and hinged in the middle so that you could fold it in half to protect the screen. This was also stolen from a friend's room, and although a contemporary school report said something like, "Now that another of Alex's games machines has been stolen, hopefully he'll learn from his experience and spend more time on his studies," well, it didn't cure my addiction. I think a contemporaneous symptom of that was when the first Gulf War broke out, and a friend excitedly told me that he'd just heard about it on the news. He was less impressed by my reaction that I'd just travelled to a new part of the galaxy that I'd never explored before in Elite 2 Frontier on my PC. The next obscure handheld machine I bought, and still have today, was a Nintendo Virtual Boy, a red and black 3D games machine that you had to hold to your face to create a virtual reality experience. This was followed by an Atari Lynx, a Sega Game Gear, and a Sega Nomad, a portable version of the Mega Drive. When the Nintendo Game Boy Color came out, this fixed the problem with their previously monochrome graphics. And so I joined the legion of fans who could play Tetris on the tube. And I upgraded to each new version of the technology, the Game Boy Advance, and then the Nintendo DS when they came out. It was only recently that I began to know that I had a problem, when I bought the Nintendo 3DS and I knew I had no great desire to play with it, but still had the urge to buy the latest gaming toy. The advent of the Apple iPhone and iPad have added a new manufacturer to my addiction. I've owned mobile phones in the past. An early mobile I loved but which had no gaming capabilities was the Sony CMR111, a tiny phone that was 6.5 by 8.5 by 2.5 centimeters, with a flip-down microphone to reach your mouth. That I lost on a bus back from Heathrow, jet-lagged after a flight from New York. The first phone I had with decent gaming capabilities was the Nokia N-Gage, a phone that also tried to be a portable games console, with a card slot for games. And that wasn't half bad as a combination of both, but was so badly manufactured it literally fell apart after I had it for a year or so. The iPhone, however, has been the one device that really works for me in terms of size and number of games. And because it's a phone as well, it means you only have to carry one machine rather than two. Admittedly, yes, my first iPhone, an iPhone 3G, which I initially bought by mistake, thinking I was getting a 3GS, also died after a couple of years, but my love of the machine meant that I upgraded to a 4S when that came out. I think spending £600 on a mobile phone does mean I have a problem. I have an iPad as well. I wasn't a fan of Macs growing up. The lack of a second button on the mouse bothered me, as did the lack of an eject button on the machine to get the bloody thing to give you your CD-ROM back. That was annoying too, but eventually the day came when I also admired an Apple computer as an object of desire. That was when the Dark Knight had a 20th anniversary Macintosh on display in the Batcave in the movie Batman and Robin. Its monolithic dark grey slab design with a vertical CD drive was iconic and ahead of its time in 1997. And the sort of thing that might have apes worship it as a form of communicating with extraterrestrial intelligence. Admittedly, the machine was used deceitfully in the film. Alfred burns a CD on it, a capability the machine didn't have, but who knows, Bruce Wayne could afford to have a bespoke one built with that capability. It didn't matter, that machine was beautiful. Perhaps my desire for that machine, although I never bought one myself, was tempered by the rest of the film being god-awful. However, becoming an iPhone owner and a Mac Mini owner in recent years inevitably led to me buying an iPad. I love my iPad too. I love stroking its surface to propel asteroids into the bodies of unsuspecting astronauts in no human. I love gently inching iridescent cubes across a maze-like landscape in Edge X. I love carjacking sporty convertibles in Grand Theft Auto 3. I love tilting my iPad from side to side to roll an insatiable feline boulder in Catball. And it's not just games, I love reading comics on the machine, dipping in and out of magazines using the Pulse app, watching TV shows via the iPlayer app as well, At the moment, I'm satisfied. I know the iPad 3 or iPad HD or new iPad, whatever you want to call it, has just come out. But I don't need one. It is higher res and it has more battery life. It is faster and it does have temporal noise reduction, which isn't a fancy form of time travel that lets you edit bad experiences out of your life, but rather lets you shoot HD video in lower light conditions. But I don't need those things. That said, if the next iPad is 3D or comes in a silver delivery, all bets are off. I want one. I do want one. I know I have a problem, and I know it's one I need to get treated. Perhaps I should sell my Panasonic Q and my Virtual Boy and my Sega Laser Active, rather than watch them gather dust in my museum of redundant technology. Perhaps. With your help, perhaps I can curb my addiction and go back to reading books instead. With your help, I'll keep coming to these meetings, and we'll see what I can do. This has been Alex Fitch, confessing all for the Pod Delusion.
And that's it for this week's show. Do check out our website at poddelusion.co.uk, where you can listen to over 2 years of archive podcasts and loads of extra stuff on the Pod Delusion extra feed, including this week our full recording of the Secularist of the Year ceremony and special podcasts from the AHS conference last Saturday, which featured David Alan Green and philosopher Richard Norman talking about Alain de Botton's new book. Also on our website, you can follow us on Twitter and like us on Facebook if you're into that sort of thing. And of course, if you do enjoy the Pod Delusion and would really like to support what you do, then put your money where your ears are and sign up and donate £5 or £10 a month, or make a one-off donation. All donations are hugely appreciated and help us make this show week in, week out. You can find links to do so at poddelusion.co.uk. And also don't forget about our partnership with Audible and download yourself a free audiobook. There's loads available. Just follow the links on poddelusion.co.uk. The Pod Delusion this week was brought to you by Liz Luckendorf, Georgia Gale Grant, Sean Ellis, Sven Rudloff, Alex Fitch and me, James O'Malley. Sketch in the Moment is by David Lovesey and Brian Too. The Pod Delusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. Thanks for listening.
Welcome on board. How are you feeling?
Well, a bit woozy. A moment ago, I was a disconnected series of feelings just sloshing across the ether. Suddenly, I'm flesh and bone and I'm cogitating.
It's to be expected. Someone's found the face of Jesus in a piece of toast, so there's a new surge of belief down on Earth. And when that happens, a new God is created. Welcome to the gang.
My word. This is unexpected. So what do I have to do?
Well, nothing much, really. Sit up here, listen to prayers.
Prayers? About what?
Oh, good point. All of us existential beings are given areas to cover. You can see the big ones over there. That's Arthur. He's the god of natural disasters. All the way down to the newer, smaller ones, like yourself. Eric here's new, and he's god of mobile communication devices with less than 8 gigabytes of storage.
What? That's a bit specific.
A lot of gods, only a finite number of areas to cover.
Well, what can I cover then?
Let's have a look. Blimey, there really isn't a lot left. God of small furry woodland animals, gone. God of dropping your iPhone, gone. We've only really got one left.
Which is?
God of atheism.
I'm sorry, you want a god of atheism? That doesn't sound like a difficult job. What do I need to do?
Well, listen to all the prayers of people that go to church regularly but don't actually believe in God. That's most parents who want their kids to go to a faith school, and 60% of the Vatican.
Why do we need all these small gods? Where's the big fella? I thought he took care of everything.
Oh, when he's here. But now he's walking the earth, testing the faith of his flock.
Really? How?
Here, I'll give you a vision. You can see him walking amongst the people.
But isn't that Richard Dawkins?
Yes, and I can't wait to see the look on Stephen Fry's face when he finds out.